Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.
Let's welcome our viewers and our listeners. This is the KL Voices in Courage podcast, and we have a remarkable guest on with us today. Andy Graham has chosen to join us, which I'm thrilled about. And one of the reasons I am thrilled is he is CEO, has been a CEO for quite a while, and in the course of his career, been quite successful. As we talked about a month ago, very clear, he is an innovator, a change agent, and a disruptor. So he was speaking my language. And that's where we connected through a mutual friend that we both adore. I'm thrilled to have him speak to the silence, I believe, that's in the C-suite, that is pervasive in the C-suite today, relative to we look successful at corporate America, and yet behind us, we almost live this double life with our families crumbling behind us or to the side of us or in front of us sometimes. So Andy has his own story, and I'm going to let you take it from here, Andy.
Thank you. And it's an honor to be invited to share my story, and appreciate the work that you're doing to give voice to that silence.
Thank you.
I'm a farm boy from South Tobacco Farm in South Carolina, raised by a single mom as part of a second marriage. And so in that context, I learned a number of things early on, which led to my eventual disruptive leadership style. And that is that on a farm, you have to figure things out. Nobody's there to figure it out for you. The job is not done until it's done, and that there are things you can control and there are things you cannot control. So my mom was a very pragmatic person. She ran a farm. She worked at a hospital as a lab technician, and she sold Tupperware on the side. And I became very adept at knowing the Tupperware catalog because I would help assemble those kits when they would show up. So I share that because it left me with a sense of drive and pragmatism that served me well from a leadership, management, a corporate life. My father was not present largely, and when he was mercurial and irresponsible. And so I was driven to be a provider, to be responsible, and to go beyond the minimum requirement, whatever it was. I didn't really have a governor in that sense. I met my wife 40 years ago, or more than 40 years ago, and she is very different than me, very sensitive, and she sees around corners emotionally. I have to do so by pattern matching.
Okay.
And we did the typical get married and have three kids 3 years apart, all in the month of December. So December is a very busy month for us. And we had them early on. Our children now are 36, 33, and 30. And my career dragged us from around the country, ended up in Phoenix for 5 years, coming from Florida, and then eventually in Austin just over 30 years ago. And in that journey, I went from corporate experience at Motorola to leading an industry-changing not-for-profit at a relatively young age and doing a venture-backed startup and then exiting that to Adidas, which are Adidas if you're on this side of the Atlantic. And so I've had pretty wide exposure to large companies, small companies, brands, technology. In my 62 years, I've seen a lot. So what was common about that thread was I was always trying to improve things and change things, but for everybody else, not necessarily for my family. If you'd said to me, are you really caring and loving your family? I would have said yes, but I would have said yes from the standpoint of being a provider and a protector in a more pragmatic sense and not so much emotionally connected and available to them. When you know that you are on airplanes and you're getting the Purple Hearts of the Flyer Awards on multiple airlines, you don't know that's a Purple Heart. And so what I would default to is I was king of the grand gesture. So we're going to go on a vacation or we're going to buy something or we're going to use the checkbook to solve certain problems.
Yeah.
So you Tell yourself a lie that you can compress time emotionally, but you cannot. I left the not-for-profit I was running. We took 12 years to set an industry standard. I am an introvert, and so leading an industry effort requires a lot of exposure and a lot of travel. And I did the math and saw that my son, who's our middle child, I had probably three more summers with him because he was in high school. And I resigned. I hired my successor, resigned, and literally went home and got off airplanes. But then you realize something, that you cannot make up for lost time. That ship had sailed. Mm-hmm. And generally, it sails a lot faster than parents realize, playing catch up ball when the kids are moving out of the door, headed out the door toward college. And my marriage was very strained because of the travel, and because, again, you can't compress time and you can't compress some relationships or the lack of presence. I went about trying to repair our relationship with our children, but then at the time, two things happened. We found out that our middle son was a cocaine addict. As he went to, he got into University of Texas as in the liberal arts program. He's in theater, and we thought things were fine, but he literally walked away from school after the first semester and physically walked away, left his dorm room. He sent us a message saying that he was basically walking away from life and everything. And we thought that he was going to commit suicide. And
yeah. So
I spent a very tense night driving around looking for him. And eventually he actually walked home. He showed up at 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And that was when we learned that he had not only been using, he had been using since he was in high school. And so what happens in addiction is that as parents, you have a tendency first to reflect at, what did I do wrong? Where did I go? There's the parental guilt, and you have that. But when you have a child with an addiction, you have it on steroids, right? And you have to learn through recovery programs that you didn't cause it, you can't cure it, you can't control it. But you don't know that at the time. So what happened with him is that he went into counseling. And essentially, the counselor is the first one who made me aware that this was a family systems issue, not he has a problem. And so that led to a key learning. It took a long time to learn it. And I'll speak to this as a man. Men are, we're problem solvers, right? Mm-hmm. And so we look at any of these things as a problem. And if you're, especially if you're a high functioning executive or leader, and you're used to being able to make things happen by virtue of force and inertia and coercion or whatever tool you use, you treat these things as problems, but they really are not. They're really a path.
Yeah.
And so what I had to learn is that it was not only a path, but it was a family systems issue, where it wasn't just our son who had the disease of addiction. It was a pattern of enabling that our family had been operating under, that I was a chief culprit of. And so the counselor said, you know, he said, you need to go, speaking to me, he said, you need to go, because I went to the place they send the counselors send people when you need more than the weekly appointments. Just so my son and I went to a place in Tennessee called OnSite, where they have it's a week-long program, and they basically take your life apart piece by piece, and they do family of origin work. They use psychodrama and any other tools necessary to get you to unpack your luggage. And I would say for me that there was an Andy 1.0 before that week in December of 2009, and then there was an Andy 2.0 that left. And the difference was I had to own up to what I was bringing to the party, you know, what the family of origin issues were. And there is just, there is simply no getting around that. You do not pass go. You do not collect $200 unless you pay those bills. And I had to learn to begin that process. So that week period of time was really opening the door and giving me language and tools to be able to work on that. And our son went through that. I went through that. My wife went through that. And the thing about doing this as a family unit is it gives you a very important thing that you need when you're working through addiction and mental illness and other kinds of problems that are over our pay grade. And that is, it gives you a common language. Because oftentimes, as parents and as adult children, you're not speaking the same language.
Right.
You may have the same heart. You may have the same intent. You're not speaking the same language. So it gave us a common language. And then our son spent 5 months in rehab. But when I say rehab, this was the Alcatraz of rehabs. This was the place you go when you've tried every other program.
Wow.
And our son would tell stories of people being in up to 20, up to 30 different stints through various rehabs.
Yeah.
And you see it. It's just the industry actually in some ways enables it, especially with insurance, because insurance will only pay for 30 days. 30 days is just, I'll just say categorically, absolutely not enough time to go work on an issue of this depth. And he was 3 months in, and his program director said, Andy, he needs another month. And that meant writing another $8,000 check, which I was happy to write. And after 5 months, he got out of the program and went into the halfway house and went through sober recovery and these sorts of things. And he was one of the fortunate ones because he's 33 now, relapsed once, almost died 2 years ago from a binge on alcohol, because you just have to change a lot of things when it comes to addiction. You have to change your environment. You have to change your relationships. You have to change a lot of things, because it only takes one pull of the thread to bring you back into that mindset, right? So I'm not comfortable in my own skin, which leads me, I guess, to share another thing that I've learned is that as a problem solver, and I'm again speaking from a male point of view and from being a high functioning leader, is that we think of alcohol or cocaine or whatever the addiction is as the problem. We think that's the problem, right? Mm-hmm. What we fail to realize and can fail to realize is that for them, it is their solution.
Yes.
And so what we're doing is we're taking away something that they need, right? Or they believe they need to be able to be comfortable in their own skin and to self-regulate. Right. And whether it's mental illness or it's addiction, your capacity for regulating yourself emotionally, for being situationally aware, being self-aware, those things they're lifelong journeys. I'd say what's changed about me is, first off, my wife now doesn't think I'm as much, excuse my French, an asshole as I was. But you learn humility, you learn empathy, you learn that you've got to be in their world, really. And what I mean by that is, and I'm jumping around here a little bit, but our daughter is bipolar schizoaffective disorder. She was diagnosed when she was 19 years old, and now she's 36. So we've lived this for a while. And when I say be in their world, here's an example of what I was commuting to Nuremberg, Germany twice a month when I was working for Adidas. And as you might imagine, that is not a sustainable commute when you're not going to move your family to Germany. And so when that came to an end, a necessary end, I would sit in a Starbucks with my oldest daughter. And after about 3 hours, the real stuff would start coming out.
Wow.
And I'm used to having 30-minute meetings, 15-minute meetings, hour meeting would be a lot, right? And then, but for her, it took that amount of time for her to start feeling safe enough to open up and say, you know what, you really are present. You're not going to go away. You're not going to leave on me. And that began a relationship with her where both my son and my oldest daughter had to process their anger at me. And I had to facilitate that to bring back some things and revisit some things with them. And both of them would say, you know what, Dad, it's okay. But I had to stop them and say, no, it's not okay. Mm-hmm. It was not okay. You have a right to feel those feelings, and you need to feel them and process them. And in both of their cases, I'm very blessed to say that they chose to turn the page on an entirely new relationship with me.
Wow.
And they're now both my very best friends, because if you think about it, your adult children will know you in a way any friend will never know you. And if you can befriend them, a truly mutual friendship, it's a hard to describe blessing. But we got there because this is what I've witnessed in my work with youth. I worked with youth for 15 years in a church context. And so I got the teenage side of what it meant to be subject to parenting any number of times and see what that difference is. And generally, what I would say is as parents, we're often trying to patch up old relationships to carry them into the future with your adult children, when really you need an entirely new relationship. It's launching a Saturn V rocket to the moon. You've got a first stage, and then you've got a second stage. And then my son, if he were here, would tell you this, is the relationship he and I have now is not a patched up version of the old one, an entirely different relationship. And you think about it, you really need that, because you both need to meet at a common point of vulnerability and of a beginning point, and then move forward from there. You're aware of history and you carry some of the scar tissue from it, but you're not defined by that. It doesn't close off emotional rooms in our mansions, right? Mm-hmm. And what I've observed with parent and child, adult child relationships is, and even marriages especially, is there's a lot of rooms can be closed off emotionally that you don't go into because of history, fear, what have you. And so what I would like to do is just to say that I'd like to think the older version of me could have visited the 30-year-old version of me and grabbed me by the collar and shake me and said, okay, I need for you to pay attention to some things here that relate to your family. I don't know that I would have listened, but I'd like to speak to those who really, they're at the end of their rope when it comes to how to deal with these kinds of situations and where their relationships are broken and counseling will not fix it and money won't fix it and the normal things you do to cope through won't fix it, and say that a lot of it had to do with me letting go. And just like the 12-step programs do, knowing that it's only by a higher power that you can reconcile these things that are not reconcilable. And it humbled me a great deal. It was a long fall because I was a CEO. I had just the status that comes with all these kinds of things. And it's hard to go from there to I'm sitting in a room with 35 other cocaine addicts with tattoos all over themselves. And now I'm holding hands and saying the Serenity Prayer. But I needed that. And my wife and I went to Al-Anon, and the initial commentary you get from somebody going to Al-Anon, which is a program for parents of those who have an addiction, is why am I here? I'm not the one with the problem. Realize is that it's your own interior work and your own inside job. And I'm going to pause and give you a break to ask different questions here, but I'm going to share this example of how this can work. When my son came back from on-site in Tennessee, and we went to dinner at my favorite Tex-Mex restaurant in Austin, and I'm thinking, I'm really curious about your experience and I'm not sure how to ask about it. So what I did is I said, Scott, his name is Scott, how can I pray for you? Which is a veiled way of saying what's going on. And he gave me some of the wisest advice that I would ever get. And he said, Dad, the way you can help me is to do your own work. And I've been doing that ever since.
Wow. Wow. Remarkable statement.
Yeah, he is an uncommon young and way smarter than me. Mm-hmm. Sure. That is a nickel tour of my story.
I always have points of curiosity. What I am really curious about is what was the turnkey moment for you that started you on your own journey? And then what was it about you that allowed you to summon the courage to do this work?
Oh, that's a great question. This is giving me chills here a little bit. So let me see if I can deliver on this. In my group at OnSite was a person who was associated with the rehab that my son eventually went to. And that man's name was Mark Houston. And he was the one who founded that program here in Austin. And so Scott had spent a year living in our home, basically surviving, because in that period of you're not using, but you're not in a period of active recovery, that's known as being a dry drunk. Mm-hmm. It was dry drunk for a year. And eventually the deal was, when I sat with his counselor, the counselor says, he said to me, Andy, this is a family systems problem. And if you want him to go to rehab, then you need to go to on-site. Mm-hmm. And that is not something I would ever have done in my, like, what? I'm going to take a week off. They're going to take my phone away from you, which they do. This is way off of my radar screen. So that was the appetizer that got my attention. Okay, this is about me. And then ultimately, we were sitting in the office with Mark Houston, who tragically passed away since. I was sitting with him, he and Scott and my wife in his office talking about Scott going into rehab. And as parents, right, we're so wanting our kids to be okay. And I was wanting him to be okay. And I was wanting to do the right thing. And I was wanting to please him. And Mark was a former guy who founded a rehab. The turning point was this. He looked at me and pointed to me and says, Andy, he's an addict. His brain has been hijacked. Could make a good decision if his life depended on it. Mm-hmm. You're the man. You have to decide. You're the one. you're the one that's just going to write a letter to say that if he walks away from this program, he's going to walk away from your family. It was a walk away, and it was that loving, pointed finger of unique responsibility that was the turning point.
Wow. And then where did you summon the courage from?
Well, I'll answer that question with a different story. Our son got out of the halfway house. He got a job. He got a roommate. He got an apartment and was living with somebody. And he got a girlfriend. And he had all these things that were apparently going well in his life. But the reality was he was not really working his program in continuity, and he was at risk. And so in a sequence of things, he lost his job. He lost his girlfriend. And he decided he was just going to ignore all the problems and he expected us to pay the bills. Now, Scott suffers from depression, and dual diagnosis of some other feature along with an addiction makes this a lot worse, right? Because depressed people can do some serious things. And it came about that he was about to be thrown out of his apartment. He had no place to live. And we had a choice. Does he come back and live with us? Do we write a check and pay for the rent? Or what do we do? And I have a mentor who advised me. He says, Andy, you need to be on the same page with your wife about this decision you're going to make, because if it ends badly, it's going to blow up your marriage. And so my wife and I prayed together. It's one of the most times of connection we've ever had emotionally, spiritually, in every respect. And we prayed for wisdom about what to do. And we realized that the choice was to let him live in his car. So we said, Scott, we're not going to enable you any further. And he literally lived out of his car for, I think, 4 months. And the risk we were taking, because my older stepbrother committed suicide, and I have a personal experience with what it's like to be left behind, is we were afraid he was going to take his life.
Right.
And so the strength and the courage came from God alone. That was the only way we could make a decision like that, is to trust that somehow he would redeem, and he did. Now, if Scott were sitting here today, he would tell you that that was one of the best decisions we ever made, because it taught him a lot of things. They find out how resourceful they can be, the sort of thing. So that was the source of the courage. When we got past that, it was strange. I would have lunch with him and he'd drive up in his car, and I knew he'd be living in his car. He'd be selling plasma in order to buy food, and he'd be eating leftovers out of restaurants and doing all these kinds of things. But what I had to do is to treat him just like I would treat anybody else, not say, hey, let me help you out or anything like that. That decision to not enable him and let him live in his car was a proof of, or that's where we got the courage. On your own, it's very difficult for parents to summon the courage internally. And this sounds a little dark, but it's because in the darkest of dark, we want plausible deniability. We want to be able to say we did everything we could. Mm-hmm. And if something goes wrong, it's not on us.
Yeah. And so in making that decision, what did you learn about yourself?
I learned that I loved my son enough to say no, and that by saying no, it was a loving thing. I learned humility through the limits, because, and I use this, I don't know where I got this, but it certainly fits, is when you have your underwear down around your ankles, nothing else really matters. And so what I learned is that when you strip everything away, it's about the connection you have with other people and how deep that connection is. And I learned that I had the capacity and I had the desire for deep connection.
Yeah.
And I still do.
And are you at that place, Andy, where you would identify this journey with Scott's addiction as a great?
Yes. Not only that, but my daughter's mental illness. I sat with her in a linoleum floor of lockdown in a mental hospital. And you would have never thought I would think of that as a gift, but it is, because it's out of that crushed fine white powder that something new can be built. I think you have to tear down the old structures if you're going to build something new.
Yeah.
And I think in God's providence, I gave a talk to a men's group one time. I got invited to do this. And I just said, I thought I knew where the end of the rope was. Wrong. I didn't know. We really don't know where the end of the rope is. But I do know that suffering and crushing is part of it. Because we know that contrast now, it is ever so richer than it possibly been in any other way. So I wouldn't have asked for it, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. It's a blessing.
And could you say a little bit about when you and I spoke on the phone, you touched on 4 years of kind of the dark night of the soul for you? Because I'm really interested in your journey that was part of the gift out of this whole experience for you.
Oh, wow. You really wanted me to get personal. So I did say that, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Let's go here. Up until that stint that I had with Adidas and the way that that ended, I knew much earlier on that climbing the corporate ladder and gaining a level of status that affords was an empty promise. But I didn't know what to do about that. In fact, I went to, there's this company, I think they were acquired by Korn Ferry. When I was involved with one of my board members in my nonprofit said I needed to go to this thing called Personnel Decisions Incorporated. And what they do is they run you through a bunch of simulations to see what your reaction is and how, you know, what your capacities are as a leader and this sort of thing. It's very effective. And at the end, a PhD named Steve Hardesty sat me down and says, Andy, you can be a CEO and you're good at it, but you have to work much harder at it than most people. If you do not do interior work, you're going to corrode yourself from the inside out. And I heard what he said and I believed it, but I didn't know what to do about it. So I got on the airplane, I flew to California, and I never thought about it again. So fast forward to 2012, my time at Adidas was over. And I'd reached a sort of a linear endpoint to that part of my career. My daughter at the time was in the throes of being in and out of, I think she was in and out of the mental hospital 15 times. And she'd been cutting herself. She'd been trying to kill herself. And this was happening at the same time in her son's addiction. And so I was brought face to face with who I was as a leader, a father, you know, all of your identities were coming up bankrupt for me. And so I ride motorcycles and I have since I was 9 years old. So I've been on several solo trips by myself. And I remember just distinctly sitting at the Solto Vista Overlook in Big Bend, Texas. I got there before the dawn and I sat there for 5 or 6 hours in a chair, watching the sun come up and then literally praying and listening and writing down in a journal what was coming down for me. And really what came down is that, Andy, you're a pretender. You're a performer. You've been doing that your whole life. And I wrote down something in the journal that I hated about myself. And that was that I was a sensitive person. My sensitivity, which was useful because it allows you to be situationally aware and predict the future differently as an introvert than most people do and that sort of thing. But whenever I ran into that, I would run the opposite direction and do the hard thing. And so what I would say is the dark night of the soul, the doorway to that is solitude and silence. You have to turn down the noise. If you don't, then you're setting yourself up for more of the same. I read a book once written by Ruth Haley Barton, and it was titled Invitation to Solitude and Silence. And that book, which I've recommended a number of times, is the book I hear the most back about. I read a lot. And so that book, I'll have guys who call me who will say months or even years later, that really was a turning point for me. And same here for me is that it turned down the noise and gave me a framing, right, to say, okay, how do I sit before my creator and listen for how I'm really made? And so much later on a beach, I opened that journal again and I read the part where it says, I hated my sensitivity. And God said to me almost audibly, says, Andy, that's not a defect. Mm-hmm. Made that way. Mm-hmm. That's how you're made. That's a gift. And I want you to lean into that. And so I did. I leaned into it and I embraced it. And later I led a community of empty nesters and it allowed me to be uncommonly vulnerable in that context and vulnerable with my kids. In fact, when Scott and I were doing this podcast together, we learned some things about me he didn't know and vice versa. Through all that rambling, I would say what I learned about my dark night of the soul experience is the doorway is solitude and silence. The tuition is putting down all of your status symbols, whatever they are, and allowing yourself to face your original design. Because we all have an original design. Mm-hmm. You've got one, I've got one, everybody's got an original design. And mm-hmm. We learn to cover that up. We learn to shape it in different ways. We'd have woundings and all these kinds of things, but we all have an original design. And the closer we can get back to that, then the more authentic we are, the more authentic we can be for other people, or we have the capacity to love, to connect in all these things. St. John of the Cross wrote a book with Teresa of Avila. And I've read that book, and I would encourage people not to read it too soon, because you've got to have a taste of the experience before you can appreciate what they're saying. Otherwise, you'll think you won't be able to take in the truth that they're offering up, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. We have different doors that we walk through, different experiences that we walk through, but everything you're saying absolutely resonates with my own dark night of the soul and my own journey. And it is absolutely, I'm a backpacker. So I remember when Sam was a teenager and I had sent him to his first rehab and then subsequently sent him to a boarding school that dealt with behavioral issues. I spent the entire summer in Montana, in the backcountry, to get back to me, to let the grief and the shame and the guilt and all the things that were weighing me down and clouding me up and keeping me dark, to let it all go so I could shine again and be centered up and true to who I really am. And it has been coming and going from different experiences. A few years ago, I did a 9-month vision quest process, which capstoned with solo event. And so the silence is absolutely necessary, and our world is not geared to allow us the silence. And so it's a countercultural thing for us to do, which takes great courage and great conviction and great intention. And so that's why I love this conversation, is because we're laying down the mantles of what we grew up thinking that we knew was success. At least my story was, everything that I thought was success was a lie.
Right.
And I didn't know it until these traumas and tragedies started showing up, and more profoundly, certainly with my son's journey. And I realized that his journey was opening the door for my journey in a much more profound way. And so that's how I can ask you, do you view this as a gift? Because unequivocally, I can say that Sam's addiction has been an extraordinary gift for me. And it has set me on the path of what my life purpose is.
Yeah.
In ways that I think the story that I would tell right now, and I realize I think that we all tell stories. And my story is that it was only through my child that I would get cracked that wide open to be able to step into my life's purpose.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I'm very grateful. In fact, Scott and I, we send each other a text each morning saying three things we're grateful for. And I know gratitude is, and some people use it as a lucky rabbit's foot, but it's when you're onward into the journey, it gets richer and richer to see what that gratefulness looks like. Stillness has really become, stillness and silence has become, I don't know if you read anything by Ryan Holiday, but he wrote a book called Stillness is the Key. People are getting the idea, especially with the advance of technology, and we have no place alone anymore, and connection of thin connection has encroached on our lives in so many areas. We looked at a time study of CEOs, and it was pretty daunting if you're in that role, your impression of time. The reason I say that is that a good friend of mine is a CEO of a public company, and I led a retreat that he was at once. It was about stillness. I borrowed an object lesson from Barton's book. And so this retreat was by a lake here in Austin. And so we went and got several jars of water from the lake, but we included silt from the bottom of the lake. And then what we did is we'd shake that jar up, and then we sat a jar on each table for people that were in this retreat, right? And when you do that, the silt is so fine, it just is very cloudy, right? And the retreat lasted, it was a weekend. So I think by the end of the second day, water was finally clear. And so when you get away, like on your backpacking or my motorcycling, right? If you're more likely to make those connections with who you are and your purpose, as you say. And I don't know if I did that. I don't know how this happened, but essentially what I did at some point during my presentation in front of the audience is I said, we can get to a level of clarity and stillness and seeing ourselves and putting down the things we hide behind, just like this jar of water. But here is the point of it all. And I literally picked the jar up and started walking, but walking in such a way as to not get that silt stir up again. Is how do you carry that whole your journey? Because there's a saying in recovery, put your own oxygen mask on or look up. Mm-hmm. Things. So that's been my life journey right there from the point of the dark night of the soul has been how do I carry that stillness with me?
Yes. And I think this is another story that I tell is I really believe this is the time for us to do that and to perfect it, to model it, to share it with others, because we are encased in the silt that's shaken right now. And those of us who dare to let the silt settle and create stillness for ourselves so that we can hear spirit or God, whatever people want to call, I think is mission critical for humanity.
I couldn't agree more. I think there's a fraction of people, I think, that carry that, let's just call it peaceful energy into a situation, right? Mm-hmm. Or that invitation to that, right? And so I think that's critical. I think I was I heard about an entire C-suite being taken through empathy training recently with another mm-hmm. public company remain nameless. And that, especially since the pandemic and the new relationship between leadership and employee base has been, if I can say it that way, in a way that leaders now are having to be much more empathetic than they ever were, right? Absolutely. To understand what's really mm-hmm. happening, right? And mm-hmm. for many of them, it's synthetic empathy because they're not naturally wired that way. Why am I saying that? Because you started this conversation with, why are not more C-suite folks talking about this, right? Or being more vulnerable, open about it? And my answer would be, is that because it's really scary. And when you are in that level of titrated competence, very difficult to put that aside and say, I'm incompetent in this particular area, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer. Not only do I not know the answer, but I don't know where this is going. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say to anybody like that who's listening, based on my experience, is that it is scary, but in the end, it is going to be okay, right? Mm-hmm. Going to be okay. You can't see it, but there's healing in that process, right? You'd otherwise not have access to. You don't like counseling. You ask yourself, who's the most empathetic person that you know has that capacity, and be willing to get close enough to them so that they can be a helpful mirror for you.
Yeah, I would say for quite a few people, it's terrifying. And I have this saying that when my life has felt like it was completely shattering and falling apart, I've done it enough times where now I know it's actually falling together.
Yeah.
And so that shattering, that terrifying experience of it shattering, and you have the pieces are just like laying out in front of you, and you have no idea how those pieces are going to come back together again or what new pieces are going to show up. That is the moment of surrender. And to do it enough times, for me, it's, oh, that's a muscle I can grow. I can know that when my life's falling apart, it's really actually falling together. And I absolutely believe that beyond a shadow of a doubt at this point in my journey. And so I think in some respects, you and I get to share our journeys with people who are in earlier phases of their journey to be able to say to them, you can do this. There is the other side to this terrifying moment or this supremely scary moment. And it's really taking us back to our own humanity.
Yeah. And so if I could add a visual to what you're saying, and I've used this before, but we all start out on our journeys with some version of an image in our mind of what it's supposed to be like. Mm-hmm. Some, it's the Norman Rockwell picture of the perfect family, or if you're a guy, but we all walk around with some image of the way we think it's supposed to be or how it's formed. And then over time, that image gets cracked and it gets broken, and we find out that we can't, it's try as we might, we can't realize this image that we have in mind, right? And then, like you're saying, when the pieces fall on the floor, what they really are is they're pieces of colored glass scattered all over the floor, and you can't make sense of it. But later on, what I've realized is that what God is doing is he's taking those pieces of colored glass and he's making a mosaic out of it. And when you see it, right, it is more beautiful than whatever the other image is that you have, right? Mm-hmm. It's just at the time you can't see it. And so you have to trust that, like you said, it's falling together. It's not falling apart. In fact, it needs to fall apart in order for that to be manifest, right? But that analogy has always helped me when I thought, okay, this is another piece of broken glass. I wonder what color it is and I wonder what it might look in the final scheme of things.
I love it. We're past the time and I could talk to you for hours. This has been super rich and I am deeply grateful for this connection. I will reach out to our friend later and let her know that she was spot on in bringing you into my life. So I want to say thank you for your vulnerability, your wisdom, your courage, and who you are in the world.
Thank you. It's been a delight. Every time I share the story, I relive it in some part, right? And so it's been, thank you for the invitation to do that. And again, for your work and for reaching out, right? And this is another one of those elements of the mosaic.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. And on your journey.
Thank you.
Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.